How is everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of The Banker Next Door. I am your host, Dr. Joe Berquist. Today, we are back in the library again as we continue our review of The Lords of Easy Money. Today, we're going to be doing chapter 6 of the book. And basically, this is the end of part 1 of the book where we cover the first 6 chapters. Now, this chapter is incredibly critical. I think after we have a chance to walk through everything, this chapter is going to be highly, highly enlightening as to just the economic functions of what the Fed did in 2010. And you're going to begin to start to see how the Fed's actions really transformed the economy over the last 15 years. So, and we're going to get into that. So before we do, I'm going to bring in my trusty PowerPoint slide here, and we're going to do a quick review on chapter 5. So in case you missed that last week, so in chapter 5, we discussed stoking asset bubbles. We looked at, you know, basically keeping the interest rates too low for too long. we then went into Greenspan's exit and Bernanke's entrance. We discussed Tom's 3 pillars and his speech at the banking symposium. Timothy Geithner comes onto the scene, what happened after the crash of 2008, and then we finished with Tom's FOMC voting record as he's heading into 2010. And we're basically going to, chapter 6 is called The Money Bomb. It covers the years between 2010 and 2012, and we're going to kick off here with Tom Hawning's no vote at the FOMC meeting. So let's get right into that here. So Tom said respectfully no. After he had cast his vote, Tom sat through the formalities while the FOMC meeting wrapped up. When the proceedings were finished, the committee members and staffers gathered their things and chatted politely as they filed out into the hallway and toward the elevators. Tom couldn't talk about what had happened in Washington because the FOMC proceedings were confidential, but Cynthia, that's Tom's wife, would read about the no vote in the media because the final vote tally was made public. I could see that it kind of physically wore him to have to do that, because who wants to be not in the general consensus on things, Cynthia said. So we have Tom basically having the no vote, and then he leaves DC, comes home, and basically his wife sees how much stress that this is putting on him, how much the toll that it's taking on him physically at this point. And we'll get into it a little bit later, but I mean, Tom's not super young anymore. I mean, he's 65 at this point and, you know, coming kind of basically toward the end of his career at the Fed. So now we get into, as we proceed, we're going to talk a little bit now about the media's coverage of the Fed. So much later, Cynthia and Tom were at a social event and she overheard him describe to a colleague how it felt to be the lone dissenter. He said it was the most daunting thing you'll ever experience, to sit in a room and your vote comes around and you say no. He said you never take that lightly. Tom knew that his vote wasn't going to actually change anything. The FOMC had all but decided to undertake quantitative easing before the meeting even started. He voted no because he felt it was his duty, but there was another reason that he did it. He was sending a message to the American public. His vote was a signal that there was, in fact, dissent over what the Fed was about to do. There had been an argument about it, and at least one person had believed that the risks of quantitative easing were too high to justify. Unfortunately, Tom's message could only reach the public in one way. The signal had to travel through the American media ecosystem of cable news shows, newspaper articles, financial wire services, and increasingly popular partisan websites. This media system was fractured and degraded in 2010 in ways that both mirrored and accelerated the decay of America's democratic institutions. This was a primary reason why quantitative easing and 0% interest rates were the most important economic policy of the decade, while also being one of the least discussed. The Fed's policies were an obsession for only a small fragment of the conservative movement, but almost totally ignored by everyone else. Let me say that again. The Fed's policies were an obsession for only a small fragment of the conservative movement, but almost totally ignored by everyone else. But this was the most important economic policy of the decade. Go figure. The Fed's policies, Oh, wait, hang on a second. Okay, so years later, an economist named Carla Binder analyzed media coverage of the Fed and quantitative easing between 2007 and 2011. Using a database of more than 300,000 news stories, the results showed that the Fed's policies barely made the news. President Barack Obama, for example, was the lead newsmaker of about 8% of all stories. Ben Bernanke was the lead newsmaker in 0.13% of stories. When the Fed was written about, it was only written about when there was some kind of ready-made press conference, like Bernanke's testimony before Congress. FOMC meetings were virtually never covered. The only outlets that did regularly cover the Fed were specialized financial news services like Bloomberg News, which sent reporters to cover even minor Fed events like speeches by regional bank presidents. But their coverage tended to focus on one thing, what the Fed was about to do and how it would affect markets. It was coverage written for Wall Street traders and barely written in English. It didn't penetrate the broader discussion. I would say that most people wouldn't have any idea what quantitative easing even was, Binder said. Let's pause for a second there. As somebody who lived through this moment and saw this and experienced this, I could tell you that that was absolutely 100% true. If I walked down the street, I could probably ask 10 people, what is quantitative easing? I might get one person who was like, yeah, I think quantitative easing is something that the Fed is doing now, whatever. I mean, 90% of people, no clue. We're just like, quantitative easing. I don't know. What is that? Is that some kind of board game or something? Like they just, yeah, it was just kind of amazing how, the media, the way that this was worked was, I mean, again, so carefully orchestrated and so carefully covered in a way as to ask questions, but not really too many questions, and just focus on what was the next thing? What was the next thing the Fed was doing, and how was that going to affect the economy in the short term? And honestly, not much has really changed from that. Okay, so let's continue on here. So let's talk about conservative coverage of the Fed's actions. Conservatives cared about the Federal Reserve far more than liberals seem to. On November 3rd, quantitative easing was the top story on the conservative Drudge Report website, which featured a headline written in big red letters that said, "Big new pump." But the conservative media covered quantitative easing in a specific way, with a deep concern about price inflation. The coverage focused on the fact that the plan would likely devalue the dollar, which sounded vaguely unpatriotic, as if it weakened the nation. Glenn Beck repeatedly mentioned the threat of hyperinflation during his long segments. You know, it will be the Weimar Republic moment. The Fed was, in fact, trying to devalue the dollar. The Dallas Fed president, Richard Fisher, pointed this out during the internal FOMC debates. Another desired benefit, as you outlined it yesterday, Mr. Chairman, is to devalue the dollar to stimulate demand for our exports. And I don't think we should ever say that publicly. Yeah, I was just about to say the Fed will never say that publicly that they are trying to intentionally devalue the dollar because nobody wants to hear that. Nobody, the people on the financial news, Wall Street doesn't want to talk about that. You know, the Fed never wants to say that they're devaluing the dollar, because if they came out and said that, not only would it be highly unpopular, but wait for it, it might cause people to start asking questions about what's going on. You don't want to have that. We don't think we should ever say that publicly, Fisher said. So devaluing the dollar wasn't seen as all bad inside the FOMC. It made American products cheaper overseas, which could stimulate exports and create jobs. But conservative critics of the Fed saw devaluation as near treasonous. The conservative author James Rickards published a book in 2011 called Currency Wars: The Making of the Next Global Crisis. Rickards was a former lawyer for the hedge fund Long Term Capital Management, which had nearly destroyed the financial system when it collapsed in the late 1990s. This book took fears of devaluation to their most extreme possible conclusion, warning that it would lead to coordinated efforts between Russia and China to dump American debt, devalue their own currency, and destabilize the American economy. Okay, couple things to unpack there. First of all, James Rickards is a brilliant man. I read his book, Currency Wars, and I was just fascinated with it. I was blown away by it. I'm going to do a whole review of Currency Wars in the very near future. So stay tuned for that. And James Rickards, his backstory is amazing. The guy's lived a very, and at least to me, has lived a very interesting life. He's written some really good books, but I mean, but Currency Wars was, that was like the, that book to me, in my opinion, will probably become a book that will be an all-time classic that people will read many, many years from now. And once you read the book, or, you know, I do the review, you'll understand what I'm talking about there. So, and James Rickards, a lot of things that James said in that book are coming true today. It took a while, but what he said was coming true. So that's one thing. The other thing is on long-term capital management. There is a great book on long-term capital management called, I believe it's When Genius Failed. And that is a whole incredible story on long-term capital management. I will get to that and I'll do a whole episode on that. But anyway, I digress. So, okay. So hold on, let's keep going here. So these books and other conservative coverage help to dampen criticism of the Fed and quantitative easing because the program's critics look like right-wing cranks. People like Rickards predicted the most catastrophic possible outcomes, like hyperinflation, but those outcomes never happened over the following 10 years. The Fed's actions did pressure other central banks to follow its leads and to print more money through their own quantitative easing programs, but it was hardly a currency war. And as had been the case over the previous decade, price inflation never rose to a serious level, let alone hyperinflation. The extremity of conservative arguments made them easy to dismiss. These arguments swept up Tom's dissent in their undertow. This is how the image hardened over the ensuing years that Tom had been opposed to quantitative easing because it would lead to price inflation or hyperinflation. The focus on price inflation allowed supporters of quantitative easing to declare victory each year that prices didn't rise sharply. Now, I will say here that yes, I think the conservatives, when the government, when the Fed starts printing money like crazy, I think you always have to raise the flag and basically say, hey, there could be major issues of inflation here, and it's something that we need to keep an eye on, and you know, this could get out of hand very quickly. In this case, they were technically proven wrong because the price inflation never materialized. Okay. However, all the other things that they warned about, you know, the devaluation of the dollar, the insane explosion of national debt, the asset bubbles, the asset price inflation, like all of those things came true 110%. But here's the interesting thing with the price inflation. We are witnessing the price inflation now. And when I get into later in the chapter here, kind of how the money was pumped into the system. See, the big difference between what happened from 2010 to 2020 versus what happened after the pandemic was that the money during the pandemic went directly into the hands of consumers. It got put directly back into your paycheck, directly into your unemployment check, directly into businesses. It was like a direct injection shot right into consumers. Here, that didn't happen. The injection of the money went into the banking system, and it went into the bank reserve accounts headed to the Federal Reserve, and then it went into money. So it didn't have the same effect. Like this money didn't necessarily go like as a direct shot straight to consumers. I mean, it went to banks, and then the banks, you know, lent the money out to help to get, you know, businesses and things growing, but it didn't quite work exactly how they had planned. And you'll see that in a few minutes. Okay, so now let's keep going here. And we're gonna now talk about Bernanke's defense of quantitative easing. So Ben Bernanke helped entrench this narrative. So in 2010, Bernanke defended the unprecedented experiment that the Fed was undertaking. But when he asked, when this person asked Bernanke about the possible downsides of the program, Pelley only focused on one thing: price inflation. Critics of Bernanke's Federal Reserve say that the $600 billion and holding down interest rates could overheat the recovering economy, causing prices to rise out of control, Pelley said. This defined the line of questioning that was fired at Bernanke, and it dramatically narrowed the nature of the true criticism raised inside FOMC meetings by Tom, Richard Fisher, Charles Plowser, and Kevin Warsh. Bernanke did not correct the misperception here. Then Bernanke said something that tainted the understanding of quantitative easing for years. One myth that's out there is that what we're doing is printing money. We're not printing money, he said. The amount of currency in circulation is not changing. The money supply is not changing in any significant way. This statement was fundamentally untrue. The money supply was already changing in significant ways and would never return to the already elevated level where it had been on November 3rd. Let me say that again. The money supply was already changing in significant ways that would never return to the already elevated level where it had been on November 3rd. The people who understood this fact best were the people like Tom and Bernanke, who understood how the mechanics of the Fed's power actually worked and who understood what it was actually beginning to do after the FOMC cast its vote. So again, you got two things going on here. You got this focus on price inflation, and you've got Ben Bernanke basically saying that, like, oh, like, we're not printing money. We're not changing the money supply. And those were just flat out lies. They were printing money and they were morphing the money supply. So now, this is perhaps these next couple sections here, starting with the trading desk at the New York Federal Reserve. These are the most critical parts. If you understand this, you'll understand exactly what happened in this period and exactly why we are where we are today. So here we go. Ready? Get ready. It's good here. So beginning on November 4th, 2010, the American financial system began to orient itself around a central hub located at 33 Liberty Street in Lower Manhattan. This was the address of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where the new era of quantitative easing would begin. The New York Federal Reserve employs a team of financial traders who usually arrive for work early, sometimes before sunrise, so they can be ready for a regular morning meeting at 9:05. The trading floors are hushed and serene, with murmured conversations and the crackling of keyboards. In many ways, it resembles any other trading floor in Lower Manhattan, but the Fed traders have special powers. Their first power is access to information that would make a big bank envious, because every bank keeps a reserve account inside the Fed. The Fed's traders can see just how much money each bank holds in its reserve vaults. The Fed can also monitor the overnight loans exchanged between banks, because these loans are made through the Fed's own transaction system. This private information is then coupled with over-the-counter data services like Bloomberg terminals to give the Fed traders an unparalleled view into America's banking system. This knowledge is combined with the second far-reaching power enjoyed by Fed traders. They are the only traders in the world who can buy things by creating new dollars. This is the basis of the Fed's ability to influence the economy and the banking system. It is often said that the FOMC sets short-term interest rates, which is true to a degree. The FOMC sets a target for the short-term rates. It is the traders at the New York Fed who make that target a reality. For many decades, they did it by buying and selling securities at exactly the right amount to make the cost of money exactly what the FOMC wanted it to be. If the FOMC wanted interest rates to go down, then the New York traders would go out and buy treasury bonds using newly created dollars. This had the effect of sucking treasury bonds into the Fed and pushing out new dollars in return. This meant that there were more dollars to go around, which lowered the cost of borrowing money, which is just another way of saying it lowered the short-term interest rate on money. When the FOMC wanted interest rates to rise, the traders did the opposite, selling treasury bonds and sucking in cash in the process, making money more scarce and therefore more expensive to borrow, as expressed in higher interest rates. The New York Fed trading team did this with the skill and expertise of a piano tuner, managing to keep the money supply at exactly the right level of tension to produce the interest rate the FOMC asked for. Unlike so much of America's infrastructure, the Fed's system for influencing financial markets was pristine and assiduously maintained. Its power and reach were breathtaking. The Fed would put this machinery to new use on November 4th when it launched the second round of quantitative easing. Now the Fed wasn't just trying to control short-term interest rates, it was trying to stimulate the entire U.S. economy. At an appointed time, sometimes twice a week, a Fed trader went into a room and closed the door behind them. They sat at a terminal accessing the Fed's proprietary trading system called FedTrade. The Fed had used this system for decades, almost daily, to buy and sell short-term securities from the most exclusive group of financial institutions in the world. These were the roughly two dozen primary dealers that had the special privilege of doing business directly with the Fed. The primary dealers included big banks and investment houses like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citigroup, and Credit Suisse. and smaller players like Nomura Securities International and Cantor Fitzgerald. From the terminal, the Fed trader put out a bid on specific asset like long-term treasury bonds or mortgage-backed securities, then waited to see which primary dealer was willing to sell at the best price. The Fed always drew bids for its auction for a very simple reason. It was the most powerful buyer in the world. It could simply create however much money it needed to close a deal. When the Fed and JP Morgan agreed on a price, say $10 billion for a bunch of treasury bills, for example, then the trader at JP Morgan would send its treasury bills to the Fed. This was the moment when the Fed trader entered a few keystrokes at the computer terminal and created the money for the transaction. When the JP Morgan trader checked the balance of the bank's reserves account at the Fed, $10 billion had appeared to fund the transaction. This is how the Fed created money on Wall Street. It took in an asset and paid for it by making new dollars inside the reserve account of primary dealers. Starting in November, the Fed traders did this transaction over and over and over again until they created several hundred billion dollars inside the Wall Street reserve accounts. There is one more important part to this process to understand. The primary dealers were not just selling the treasury bills and mortgage bonds that they happened to have on hand. If that had been the case, it would have limited how much money the Fed could have pushed into the banking system. Even the primary dealers only had a finite amount of such assets on hand. Instead, the Fed set up a conveyor belt of sorts, which used the primary dealers as middlemen. The conveyor belt began outside the Fed with hedge funds that were not primary dealers. These hedge funds could borrow money from a big bank, buy a treasury bill, and then have a primary dealer sell that treasury bill to the Fed for new cash. In this way, the hedge funds could borrow and buy billions of dollars in bonds and sell them to the Fed for a profit. Once the conveyor belt was up and running, it began magically transforming bonds into cash. The cash didn't stay safe and sound inside the reserve accounts of primary dealers. It started flowing out into the banking system looking for a place to live. So there's a lot there. We talked about basically the New York Fed trading desk, how powerful it is. We talked about the mechanisms that they use internally, how they have their own proprietary trading system called, you know, Fed Trade. And we basically go through like how they moved long and short term interest rates, you know, the mechanisms by which they use. So now, you know, they're going to the primary dealers, they're selling them an asset, and then they're pumping cash into their trade accounts. But they didn't stop there. They then went to the hedge funds. They got all the hedge funds on Wall Street involved and said, hey, guys, the primary dealers are not enough for this operation. We now need to bring in all the hedge funds who are not primary dealers. They brought them into this whole mix and got them involved in this whole conveyor belt, as they called it, for basically pushing this money out into the system. So now we're going to talk about what were the effects of quantitative easing. So the money changed the world, primarily by changing the behavior of people and institutions that had already had a lot of money. Each dollar created by quantitative easing put pressure on the dollars that already existed, like water pushing into an overflowing pool. This pressure was intensified by the fact that the Fed was already holding short-term interest rates at zero. The Fed was essentially coercing hedge funds, banks, and private equity firms to create debt and do it in riskier ways. The strategy was like a military pincer movement that closes in on the opponents from two sides. From one direction, there was all this new cash. And from the other direction, there were the low rates that punished anyone for saving that cash. The Wall Street types developed a name for this strategy. They called it ZIRP, which was short for zero interest rate policy. Economists talked about ZIRP in terms of interest rates, but on Wall Street, there was a deeper appreciation for the combined power of new money and low rates. The hedge fund and investors could see how ZIRP was reshaping the world because they were the people who were doing it on ZIRP's behalf. So there's a very, very important sentence in here. It goes, from one direction, there was all this new cash. And from the other direction, there were the low rates that punished anyone for saving that cash. They punished anyone for saving that cash. It's critical to understand that what the Fed did here with the ZIRP and pumping the cash into the system, they punished savers. They punished retirees and they punished savers. They punished retirees because they removed what's called the risk-free rate from the system by effectively putting interest rates at zero. What is the risk-free rate? The risk-free rate is what you have right now. You can go to a bank and you can get a CD at 5%. You can buy a three-month T-bill at 5.45%, something in that neighborhood today. That's the risk-free rate. You can buy these financial instruments and you get a return and you take zero risk. That's the risk-free rate. And we're going to get into a lot more of this here. But basically, if you were a saver, interest rates on savings accounts and everything paid what? It paid next to nothing. CDs paid next to nothing. Short-term treasury bills paid next to nothing. So you had to take your money and go elsewhere. You had to take more risk with your money. So now that's how savers were punished. That's how retirees who were on fixed income were punished because they couldn't earn basic returns on this stuff anymore. The Fed was forcing people not to save money, companies not to save money, retirees not to save money. They wanted to get the spending going to get the economy going again. But this has, nobody had ever done this before, and it had dramatic ramifications. So now let's look at the effects of ZIRP and the end of the risk-free rate. So to understand the effects of ZIRP, it's useful to think about the whole thing from the perspective of a greedy hedge fund manager who had to make a living in the world that ZIRP created. This hedge fund manager might have participated in the debt-to-cash conveyor belt and sold treasury bills to the Fed for a profit of $1 million. The first thing this hedge fund manager is going to think about when that $1 million lands in their account is the prevailing interest rate. The interest rate imposes a lens through which they will view everything else because the interest rate is what the $1 million can pay them for doing nothing, i.e. the risk-free rate. If the interest rate on a long-term treasury bill is 4%, the hedge fund owner can stash their money in treasuries and earn $40,000 a year, essentially risk-free. See, just what I just said. Lots of people are going to visit this hedge fund manager to convince them not to stash their cash in, or stash their money in treasuries, but rather to invest their money in whatever scheme that particular visitor happens to be promoting. There are many kinds of people who visit hedge funds asking for money. There are pathologically optimistic oil executives from Texas raising money to drill fracking wells. There are commercial real estate developers from Miami with plans to build new luxury condominiums. There are stock portfolio managers who use the word diversify so much that it sounds like a holy incantation. These people parade through conference rooms and display their PowerPoint presentation, and they always have a sword hanging over their head. The sword is the 4% interest rate or the risk-free rate. They all need to make a very convincing case that their project, whatever it is, will produce a higher profit higher than 4%, which is the riskless return on a 10-year treasury bill. This is how things worked for decades, but they no longer work that way after 2010. So it's like this. So again, all these examples that he gives. So I go into the hedge fund manager and I say, listen, I want to borrow, you've got $100 million and I want to borrow that to go do my condo. My condo development down in Miami. So if I'm the hedge fund guy, I'm going, okay, well, let's see your projections. I take out the projections. I show it to him. If that interest rate is not something, not just above 4%, because we're using 4% from our example here. If it's not something significantly above 4%, I mean, it better be 15, 20, 25% return. Otherwise, what's the point? I'll just, it's not worth it. As they say, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. That you're not getting paid an equivalent return for the risk that you're taking. You know, otherwise I'll just go put the money in the bank and I'll make $400,000 or whatever, or $4 million or whatever, and call it a day because I don't really need to do it. And that's how things work for years and years. Another example I would put in here is the unicorn stock. Facebook, NVIDIA comes in and says, hey, I got this great plan and I need money. And if you put your money in me, I can issue you a 7% return, an 8% return. Well, as we will see here in a second, that return is better than zero. So you saw a lot of money flying into big tech, but from the years 2010 all the way up until most recently, until interest rates started to increase in 2022, for that 12-year period of time, you saw a crap ton of money flowing into big tech. So, but anyway, we'll continue that thought in a second. Let's just keep going here. So short-term interest rates were held at zero for many years, which meant other interest rates were also historically low. Quantitative easing intensified this effect with an intentional and strategic way. The program's primary goal of quantitative easing was to make sure that the long-term benefit of saving money was lower with each passing month. The New York Fed traders achieved this effect by purchasing certain treasury bills, namely the longer-term bills, such as the 10-year treasuries. This was new. In earlier years, the Fed controlled the money supply by purchasing only short-term treasury bills. The Fed was buying the long-term bills because doing so was like closing the one safe deposit box where Wall Street investors could stash their money. Before the financial collapse that started in 2007, the reward for saving money in a 10-year treasury was 5%. So that means, so by the autumn of 2011, the Fed helped push it down to about 2%. So right there, the 10-year treasury got pushed down from 5% to 2%. So again, you're punishing savers. So much of our lives are run off the 10-year treasury. They wanted to dramatically reduce those short-term interest rates. And so now we're going to get into the ultimate effect of this, which is called the search for yield. So the overall effect of ZIRP was to create a tidal wave of cash and a frantic search for any new place to invest in. The economists called this dynamic the search for yield or a reach for yield, a once obscure term that became central to describing the American economy. The people who had real money, meaning billions of dollars, were set on the search for investments that yielded anything more than zero. Now, when a pathologically optimistic fracking wildcatter visited the hedge fund, they got a far more sympathetic hearing. Their PowerPoints included figures on the productivity of oil wells that might seem riskily inflated. But the hedge fund manager was more likely to think, why not? It beats zero. The Miami condo developer talked up sketchy forecasts about the demand for new units, but taking a chance on the project still beat zero. And the well-dressed portfolio manager who was pushing shares of stock, shares that seemed wildly expensive when compared to actual profits of the company underpinning them, that investment also beat zero. If the unicorn tech startup came in and said, hey, we're reaching for $1 billion valuation, we need you to pump money into the company, still better than zero. Now I added that example. So, but the search for yield didn't just pressure risk-hungry hedge fund managers. It also pressured the most conservative and wealthy institutions like big pension funds and insurance companies. These institutions had enormous sums of cash and they depended on interest payments to remain solvent. Let me say that again. They depended on interest payments to remain solvent. When interest rates are 4%, a pension fund might be able to meet all of its payment obligations with just $10 million saved in treasury bills, because the $10 million will kick off regular interest payments. When rates are pushed close to zero, the pension fund is suddenly insolvent and must start a search for yield. Now, even the pension funds will be taking a hard look at fracking wells and luxury condo developments. This is why ZIRP caused asset prices to rise. When people search for yield, they buy assets. This increased demand drove up the price for corporate bonds, stocks, real estate, and even fine art. The asset price inflation was not an unintended consequence of quantitative easing. It was the goal. The asset price inflation was not an unintended consequence of quantitative easing. It was the goal. The hope was that higher asset prices would create a wealth effect that bled out into the broader economy and created new jobs. It was entirely clear to senior leaders at the Fed that to achieve the wealth effect, ZIRP must first and foremost benefit the very richest people in the country. That's because assets are not broadly owned in America. According to the Fed's own analysis, in early 2012, the richest 1% of Americans owned about 25% of all assets. The bottom half of all Americans owned only 6.5% of all assets. So when the Fed stoked asset prices, it was helping a vanishingly small group of people at the top. Wow. And there it is right there, ladies and gentlemen. That is the crux of what this was. ZIRP They wanted asset prices to rise. And the asset price inflation was not unintended. It was the goal. The goal was to increase asset prices. And who did this benefit? It benefited the very wealthy. It benefited the 1%. It benefited the top 10%. And it made them fabulously rich. It made them fabulously rich. And it created an income inequality gap in this country that we have never seen. And we're still suffering the effects of that to this very day. You just have to stop for a second and kind of absorb that, because that's a huge thing to absorb. It was entirely clear to senior leaders at the Fed that to achieve the wealth effect, ZIRP must first and foremost benefit the very richest people in the country. So they went out of their way to create asset inflation to benefit the richest people in the country. This was their plan, and they knew it, and they knew they were doing this. They knew that they were going to screw savers. They were going to screw retirees. They were screwing the pension fund holders and the insurance companies, and they were going to make the richest people. They were going to make hedge fund managers, and they were going to make a lot of people. The top 1% were going to get stupid rich off of this, and they knew it, and they went out and they did it anyway. And like I said, at the very beginning of this thing, I said, if you thought you were mad or didn't like the Federal Reserve at the beginning of this book, I said, wait till you get to the end. And now this is, it's hard to imagine. This is just the beginning. Okay. So now let's talk about the people at the top. So the people who benefited most from this arrangement tended to talk about it the very least. Very few hedge fund operators seemed eager to complain about the way that ZIRP widened income inequality and fueled speculative debt bubbles. One of the unspoken rules of Wall Street, in fact, is that those who know don't show. If a trade is turning a profit, then people who know about it don't talk about it, because doing so might draw a crowd and risk the trade itself. So the public rhetoric around quantitative easing remained dominated by inflation doomsayers, who focused only on price inflation, which never materialized. The arguments made by people like Tom were mostly ignored. And after 2010, he would no longer be making them inside the FOMC. So there you have it right there. The people on Wall Street, you know, the people, you know, if you're watching CNBC and Bloomberg and Fox Business every day back then, they didn't want to talk about that. They didn't want to talk about how they were getting stupid rich, how they were all becoming billionaires and making hundreds of millions of dollars. And you know, they didn't want to talk about that, because this now was the moneymaker. This was the golden goose. You're not going to kill the golden goose. Okay. Now we're going to get into Tom's retirement from the Fed. So in early 2011, Tom retired from the Kansas City Fed at the age of 65. When NPR did a story about it, they referred to him as Fed dissenter Tom Hoenig. His reputation had been set. In January, Tom gave a speech in Kansas City to a local business group. It was basically his goodbye speech as Fed president. He didn't use the occasion to press his arguments against quantitative easing or 1% interest rates. He gave a short speech instead about the value of dissent inside the Fed. He pointed out that the FOMC had been constructed to include members from around the country, not just Fed governors who were appointed in Washington, D.C. In this structure, it is a key point to remember that each FOMC member was given a vote, not an advisory role, Tom said. A deliberative body does not gain credibility by concealing dissent when decision-making is most difficult. Tom had dissented and he had lost. The monetary experiment was now underway. As for me, I recognize that the committee's majority might be correct. In fact, I hope that it is. However, I have come to my policy positions based on my experience, current data, and economic history. He said, if I had failed to express my views with my vote, I would have failed in my duty to you and to the committee. So again, a big thing to point out here, and we talked about it in earlier chapters. We talked about it in what happened at the Fed when we looked back in retrospect at the Fed's decisions in the 1970s. We looked back at Alan Greenspan and the Fed and their decisions in the 90s that led to the asset price inflation that led to the stock bubble, the dot-com bubble, as it were, that basically imploded in 2000. you know, Tom had seen this story before. He had seen this script before. He had been wrong before, but he also understood a key critical element that these things can take years to play out. They don't always happen in 6 months or a year or 2 years or whatever. And what's, I think, most difficult for people to grasp is the fact that, you know, something happens 6 or 7 years or maybe even 10 years down the road and they don't link, you know, 10 years down the road, they forgot about all the stuff that happened in 2020. People forgot all about everything that happened back in 2010. Nobody's thinking about that. Nobody wants to talk. Oh, that's ancient history. It happened 10 years ago, whatever. But you can draw the dotted line from that event to this event 5 years later, 7 years later, 10 years later. And it can take that long in economics for these things to play out. And that's one of the key things that I think you take away from one of the hard key lessons you take away from this book is that these things, they're lagging effects that take time to run through the economy. So now let's talk about inflating the U.S. monetary base. So between November of 2010 and June 2011, quantitative easing pushed $600 billion new dollars into the financial system. The monetary base of the United States, meaning the core pool of new money that only the Fed can create, rose by a total of $720 billion between November of 2010 and June of 2011. In about 7 months, the Fed injected more money into the banking system than it had in the 30 years prior to 2008. The banks were overflowing with more cash reserves than they had ever seen in history. By the summer of 2011, the value of excess cash reserves in the banking system reached $1.6 trillion, an increase of 96,000% from pre-crisis levels. At first, there were encouraging signs that ZIRP might be helping the broader economy. The unemployment rate began to fall, slowly but steadily, in the months after quantitative easing ended. But as time passed, the broader benefits that Bernanke and others had hoped for proved elusive. When quantitative easing was launched in November, the unemployment rate was at 9.8%. When the program finished in the summer of 2011, the unemployment rate was still 9%. Economic growth was, by the Fed's own measures, still anemic and uncertain. To achieve these small gains, the Fed had distorted the financial system in ways that would not be easy to undo. And there is another key element there to understand. The Fed had distorted the financial system in ways that would not be easy to undo. Now, here's another thing, and we're going to get into this later in the book. So the excess cash reserves in the banking system reached $1.6 trillion. Okay, this plays in to the repo market. And we're going to get into that later in the book, and you're going to see how vitally critical the repo market is and how the Fed took the repo market as kind of a sleepy little market and turned it into the primary liquidity market in the U.S. economy. And we're going to, and that becomes critically important in 2019. And it's critically important right now today to understand what's going on there. So, okay. And now let's finish up with Bernanke's push for more quantitative easing. So Ben Bernanke became single-minded in his drive to do more. If the new round of quantitative easing worked only marginally well, then maybe another, even larger round might work better. If the banks weren't lending as much money as the Fed desired under the pressures of ZIRP, then ZIRP could be intensified. This is what Bernanke proposed doing in the summer of 2012. By this time, Bernanke would face far more opposition than he had faced in 2010. During an FOMC meeting in the summer of 2012, 6 out of the 12 FOMC members expressed skepticism about launching a new round of quantitative easing. If even 3 of these members voted against Bernanke's plan, it would show the world that the Fed was uncertain about its experiments. Bernanke worked hard to make sure this didn't happen. He began politicking within the FOMC, building support for his plan to escalate the Fed's intervention. Bernanke's strongest opposition came from a group of 3 Fed governors who began to work together to slow or hinder this plan. One of these governors proved to be a formidable critic of ZIRP, at least within the closed sessions of the FOMC meeting. His name was Jeremy Powell. And he was a relatively new addition to the Fed board, having been appointed by Barack Obama in 2012. Powell raised many of the same concerns that Tom had raised, but Powell came to those concerns from a different path. He had spent his career in the world of private equity deal making. He had grown wealthy helping create and sell risky debt. When he joined the Fed, he began to point out just how risky that debt could become to the broader economy. Unlike Tom, Jeremy Powell would actually be listened to. He would, in fact, rise to the highest levels of power inside the Fed. And during the years that he ascended to the role of Fed chairman, he provided some of the clearest warnings of just how dangerous quantitative easing might become. Okay, everybody, that ends chapter six. And that ends the first section of the book. So we're through, man. We're through the first six chapters. We got 12 chapters left. I think there's six chapters in section two, six chapters in section three. And as you can see, I hope you're beginning to understand as we go through this why I'm breaking this down chapter by chapter, because there's so much going on here and there's so much you have to understand in terms of the context and the story and the inner working of the Fed and how these things go on and the different leaders at the Fed, from, you know, Volcker to Alan Greenspan to Bernanke to Yellen to Jeremy Powell, and how all these people did different things, but they all was like Legos, like building blocks. What they did all built upon the other, bringing us to where we are today. So again, I hope everyone is enjoying this series. I hope everyone is enjoying this book. If you don't have a copy of this book, I really hope you would go out, consider going out and buying one. I don't get any benefit for that. I'm just, you know, trying to give a good plug there. But definitely go out, read this book, share it with other people. Hopefully share what you're learning here in these podcast episodes. And I hope that this, as you study this and you learn about it, it's going to give you a lot more understanding into the Fed and what's going on with the general economy. And, you know, just, I can't wait to get into the next two sections here, because we kind of got through what I would call the base of stuff. And now we're going to go into this second section, which leads us up to 2019, 2020. And you really begin to see the ramifications of what the Fed did. And then we get into, you know, the pandemic and kind of what happens thereafter. So, but anyway, thanks for listening. If you like this video, please make sure to like, share, subscribe, leave your comments below. That always helps the channel. And I will be back again to see everybody real soon. Yeah, next week, basically off for Easter. And then I should be back the following week with the next episode of this installment. So stay tuned for that. All right. See everybody later.